Live from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal, the program that puts it all into focus.
We can't just drill our way out of this problem.
Welcome to the Daily Wrap. And now, here's your host, Michael Kastner.
The father of the man who killed Trayvon Martin gives his son's side of the story of that tragic night. We'll have that interview. The president calls on the Senate to stop tax incentives for oil companies. The Senate says no. We'll break down the turndown with the Houston Chronicle. And alarming news about the growth of autism in our country. One in 58 boys in the U.S. have it. We'll be talking with the folks at WebMD. Welcome to the Daily Wrap from the Wall Street Journal. I'm Michael Kastner. Hold it. It's improper English. I was trained this way. One in 58 boys in the U.S. has it. So I don't want my English teacher coming after me. That she listens. Well, first up, we're going to be getting into the Trayvon Martin case. Now, on our website, dailywrapwsj.com, we have the video that shows George Zimmerman, the guy who says he killed Trayvon Martin, 17-year-old unarmed kid in Sanford, Florida, the end of February, because he was being attacked by Trayvon Martin. He says he shot him out of self-defense. He said that he received quite a beating from Trayvon Martin, that his nose was broken, that his head was, back of his head was bashed in the concrete. The video that has been leaked now, and as I said, we have it on our website, doesn't show what would appear to be a broken nose. And a generally broken nose, I'm not a doctor. I've seen people with broken noses, and you're gushing blood. And I've seen various medical experts taking a look at the video because obviously this is being tried on television. They say there's going to be blood down the front of somebody's shirt if you've got a head wound. You're going to have blood on the back of your shirt. More than likely, if you're being treated for two pretty serious wounds, if you will, injuries, you're going to be taken to the hospital. He was not. He was in handcuffs that night. And you see that in the video, and you don't see any blood on his clothes, and you don't see from the video obvious wounds. I do want to say this, though. The video is grainy. You can't make out for sure. But that's what it appears. If the nose was broken and gushing blood, that part you would have at least seen. If there were, you know, more minor injuries or whatever, you could not see that, first of all. And also, the police do not appear to be wearing rubber gloves, which they do any time there is any danger of them coming in contact with bodily fluid, such as blood. Now that, as I said, is out. So our statements now by George Zimmerman's father, Robert Zimmerman. He was speaking to WOFL, Fox 35, in Orlando, Florida. This is what he has to say on what his son said started the events that night.
It's my understanding from everything I've heard from George and from everyone else. George was going to the store. He saw someone in his community that he did not recognize as living there, walking behind some townhomes. Because there had been a lot of break-ins in the area, he thought that was suspicious, that someone would not be walking on the street or the sidewalk, that they'd be walking right behind the townhomes.
And then Zimmerman says his son told him what happened after he had called the police.
It's my understanding that at that point, Trayvon Martin walked up to him, asking, "Do you have a problem?" George said, "No, I don't have a problem," and started to reach for his cell phone. At that point, he was punched in the nose, his nose was broken, and he was knocked to the concrete.
And then Zimmerman says what his son told him happened right before Trayvon was shot.
After nearly a minute of being beaten, George was trying to get his head off of the concrete, trying to move with Trayvon on him into the grass. In doing so, his firearm was shown. Trayvon Martin said something to the effect of, "You're going to die now, or you're going to die tonight," something to that effect. He continued to beat George, and at some point, George pulled his pistol and did what he did.
Now, the 911 tapes that we've played on this program, you've heard those on network newscasts as well. You hear screaming, "Help me, help me," in the background from the 911 calls. And George Zimmerman's dad says, "I know that that's my son." Now, Trayvon Martin's mom says, "No, I know that's my son." And further in this interview with Fox 35 in Orlando, George Zimmerman's dad talks about that video that we just discussed showing his son in handcuffs and what some are saying are a lack of visible injuries.
I have no idea what the video showed. I haven't seen it. I know his nose was broken. His scalp was cut in two different places. I don't know. He wasn't given any medical attention, but they may have cleaned him up there at the scene. I have no idea.
We're joined now by Lawrence Elliott, author of several books, including Four in the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. And he also penned a piece in the Huffington Post today, Trayvon Martin is not a symbol for vigilante justice. With that headline in mind, I have to ask about the comments we've been hearing from members of the new Black Panther Party offering up a reward for the capture of Trayvon shooter George Zimmerman.
It's terrible. That's the dumbest thing for anyone to do. I particularly wasn't impressed with the spokesperson either. But my point is, anybody who does that, first off, you're spitting in the eye. You're soiling our justice system because you're saying, in 2012, the only justice a black family can get is to kill someone on the street, which is terrible. That's a ridiculous, silly message to be giving to our young people. And another thing is that whoever does it, and if they're black, just as Trayvon was found guilty by this gentleman by stopping him on the street because of other criminals that may have looked like him, now I will be associated with this person who commits this crime. Because I know, you know, Mr. Zimmerman may not want to go peacefully. What are you going to do? Mm-hmm. Is he going to get killed, beaten up, what? And I don't think that's a good thing. Not in this time that we're living right now where I'm so glad I'm not looking at riots. I'm here in Germany, and it's almost like I'm looking from Mars at what's going on in the United States. And right now, I don't want to see a riot.
We're talking to Lawrence Elliott. He wrote a piece in the Huffington Post, Trayvon Martin is not a symbol for vigilante justice. The piece clearly came from your soul. It seems like you're saying that the Trayvon Martin case has opened up a whole can of worms, but it's good because it's forcing us to have a conversation that we weren't having.
Absolutely. I think it is good. That's a painful conversation, but it's good medicine.
Explain the one episode that you describe in here when you were a kid and you ran out of a store and you were greeted by two police officers with guns pointed at you.
Yeah, I attended a church in a particular neighborhood, and we sang in the choir, and once in a while at the middle of the service after we were finished singing, one of us would get money together and we'd run to a store and get some candy. I happened to be doing that, and I was wearing my church choir outfit as well, which was a white shirt and black pair of pants. Mm-hmm. Ran in, got the candy, and as I was running out, because I was on time limit, mm-hmm. The cop stopped me, and I turned, and I'm faced with guns. And they assumed I was running out of a store stealing, and their language was obviously abrupt. And they were asking why I was running and what you're doing. And definitely the questioning led me to believe I was being accused of being a thief, which I wasn't. But that's just an early lesson that you learn, that you cannot run out of stores like that.
This
as well
is
as many other things.
This is a conversation that we've had with Goldie Taylor, who appears on MSNBC and CNN, and she calls it the conversation.
Yes.
That black parents have, and she's had it with her sons.
Oh, yes. My mom, too.
Explain it.
Well, my mom used to tell me when you're stopped by the cops, basically you want to take control of the situation. By that, you mean you tell the cops, my hands are in the air, what do you want me to do? I have my wallet, tell me what you want me to do. You're basically letting him know you've complied, and yet you want him to tell you what to do next, mm-hmm. because you don't want any accidents. And it's a responsibility. I once told a white friend of mine, her name is Rhonda, and she said that I have had two boys and I never had to talk with them about that.
Yeah.
I said, I know, but if you have two boys and they're my color and you're in that neighborhood, you're going to have that conversation. And I know I didn't want to hear that from my mom, This was the 70s, and, you know, trying to assert your rights. I have my rights, blah, blah, blah. But she used to tell me, on the streets, you have no rights. That cop has your life in control. And so you pretty much have to do what you can to get home alive. And that's basically what she tried to do. And it's become second nature. I tell friends here in Germany about it, and they look at me like, how could you live like that? But I said, you've been told, and you've done it so many times, that it's second nature.
Or else.
Yeah, or else you're dead. That's the bottom line. You're dead if you don't do what you're supposed to do.
Lawrence Elliott, author of several books, including Four in the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. You've got to see this. Matter of fact, I think we'll put a link to your Huffington Post piece as well up on our website.
Nice.
It's dailywrapwsj.com. Talking to us all the way from Germany tonight. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. And you guys take care, and we're praying for America.
As the Daily Wrap continues, President Obama asks the Senate, hey, stop the taxpayer subsidies to the oil companies. Well, the Senate thumbs their nose at the president. Going to have that all broken down for us from folks at the Houston Chronicle. That and more straight ahead here on the Daily Wrap from the Wall Street Journal. I'm Michael Kastner.
Putting the big events into focus. The Daily Wrap from the Wall Street Journal with Michael Kastner.
The Daily Wrap continues. Michael Kastner with you. President Obama's in the Rose Garden this morning urging Congress to stop taxpayer subsidies for oil companies.
Instead of taxpayer giveaways to an industry that's never been more profitable, we should be using that money to double down on investments in clean energy technologies that have never been more promising.
And the president was talking about the choice that the House and the Senate had to make.
Today, members of Congress have a simple choice to make. They can stand with the big oil companies, or they can stand with the American people.
We're joined now by Puneet Kolapara, reporter for the Houston Chronicle and contributor to FuelFix.com. Break down what happened in the Senate today and why the president's bound to be ticked off.
Well, essentially what happened is the Senate, as expected, voted down a measure that would have repealed a number of incentives for the biggest oil and gas companies. And basically, the measure needed 60 votes to pass to clear this procedural hurdle, but it only got, I believe, 51 votes. And so essentially, Obama had gotten out in the White House Rose Garden, and he had made this plea to the senators to pass this measure to repeal the tax incentives. But then literally within an hour, the Senate had voted it down, and it failed to clear that procedural hurdle.
Explain this in layman's terms for us. Now, if you take a look at it and you're just the average Joe pumping your gas, you're thinking, well, if you are going to take away tax breaks for oil companies and it's going to cost them more money, then aren't they just going to pass that cost on to me? And isn't that going to drive up the price of my gasoline?
Well, that's certainly an argument that you've been hearing a lot from Republicans and industry groups such as the American Petroleum Institute. They've really been trying to hammer home this point that if you take away their tax incentives, the costs for producing oil and gas could go up, and some of that additional cost could be passed on to consumers. Now, there are some reports that have come out, including one from the Congressional Research Service, the nonpartisan research arm of Congress, that said that if you were to take away the tax incentives for the biggest companies, it wouldn't have much of an effect on the price of gasoline and on the costs of production.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Puneet. I don't even think this is a Republican or Democratic thing. I mean, you know, all you have to do is be a consumer and realize, you know, especially with banks, these guys aren't going to absorb a penny of extra costs. They will pass it down on us, won't they?
Well, to an extent, you know, some economists might say that may be what happens, because the demand for gasoline, it tends to be what economists call price inelastic. That is to say that, you know, when the price changes a lot, if it goes up a lot, you're not going to see a very big reduction in the consumption because consumers don't have any alternatives to gasoline as far as transportation fuels go right now.
Yeah. But if you start cranking it up going in towards, you know, $5 a gallon, I mean, somebody's more than willing to move at that point to lessen their commute. They're more than willing to carpool at that point. But my point being here is not picking sides with the president or Republicans or Democrats. At a time when our gas prices are up, I guess what most of us are kind of thinking is now really the time where you want to send some costs on to oil companies when really at the end of the day, our opinion is we're just going to have to pay more at the pump. That will be passed on to us.
Well, one thing that President Obama and many of the Democrats in Congress have been arguing is that, well, the oil and gas companies, the biggest ones anyway, have been taking in even higher and higher profits, you know, to the tune of something like $130 billion last year is what one Democratic senator said on the floor today. And essentially what they're saying is that, you know, with them taking in these profits and yet consumers are still suffering at the pump, and yet the oil companies still have these tax incentives, and yet gasoline prices seem to be going up. So that seems to be the main line of attack by Democrats and the president. It's a very much a sort of trying to tap into populist discontent, if you will, with the oil industry.
Discontent is such a very polite word for how we're feeling right now. Puneet Kalapara, reporter for the Houston Chronicle and contributor to FuelFix.com, talking to us from Washington, D.C. tonight. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also in the political world, Sheldon Adelson. He's a billionaire casino mogul. He's the guy who basically is the chief underwriter for Newt Gingrich's Super PAC. Listen to what he had to say about the future of the Gingrich campaign.
It appears as though he's at the end of his line. Because, I mean, mathematically, he can't get anywhere near the numbers, and is not unlikely to be a brokered convention.
And this news is coming out. Mitt Romney has confirmed a secret meeting with Newt Gingrich last week in New Orleans. He said, oh, we always just stay in contact, you know, and all that. Yeah, you don't do it at 6:30 in the morning. And Newt was staying 30 miles away from where Mitt was. What's going on there? We're going to be digging around on that to keep abreast of what's happening. Secret goings on there. Are they going to be teaming up? Coming up, autism rates alarmingly on the rise in the U.S. Straight ahead here on the Daily Wrap.
Fresh insights, candid opinion, world-class reporting. This is the Daily Wrap from the Wall Street Journal with Michael Kastner.
The Daily Wrap continues. Michael Kastner with you. Story came out today that will absolutely blow your mind. One in every 88 U.S. kids and one in 54 boys has autism. That according to the Center for Disease Control. Is your jaw dropping yet? Daniel Danoon is joining us. He's senior medical writer for WebMD. Daniel, I don't want to, you know, cause panic or anything, but man, if I were a parent, I'd be worried right now.
Well, if you're a parent, you ought to be concerned. Parents really do need to be looking at their kids and asking themselves all during their early years, is my kid hitting the milestones? And if not, they need to be getting the kid into treatment pronto.
Why is this number so high? Has it always been like this? Is it because, you know, more and more kids are getting autism, or is it because we just didn't detect it before?
Man, is that a good question, and we just don't know. The opinions vary widely. Dr. Frieden, the head of the CDC, thinks it's all because we're finally getting good enough at identifying it that we're getting down to the true prevalence of what's going on, and as time goes by, we're getting better and better at finding it. Other people say, sure, that's going on, but half these cases are due to something else. There's got to be something happening. The CDC has got a huge study going on that's looking at all the different risk factors, but they just started that a few years ago, and their first results won't even start coming out till the end of this year, and we won't really know anything about it for a while yet. Until then, we're just going to have to be thinking about what to do about it and not trying to drill down too much about what the cause is.
Well, let me ask you that then. We're talking with Daniel Dehnoon, senior medical writer for WebMD, and this just heartbreaking story that came out today. Autism is up 23% from 2006 to 2008. One in every 88 U.S. kids, one in 54 boys has autism. If you find out that your kid has autism, what can you do?
There's really depends on where you live and what you can afford, I'm afraid, at this point. But it's still not a bad case. Every single kid can, in their communities, find resources. There are educational resources that are available in every single community. You can go to the Autism Speaks website, and you can just type in your zip code, and they'll return immediately to you who you can call for help. And if you even have any suspicion, you should check this out. Now, the CDC and Autism Speaks both have what the normal guidelines are about what a kid should be doing at 1 month, 2 months, 4 months, 1 year old. And if you sort of suspect that your kid's not hitting those milestones, don't freak out, but get some help, get someone to look at it, because the earlier you treat this, when kids' brains are still forming, there's a lot that can be done. But once the kids' minds are kind of set, it's a lot harder to overcome.
You know, if you're thinking about having a kid right now and you hear a figure like this, I mean, it's got to break your heart. It's got to scare the hell out of you.
I think there are a lot of concerned parents, and the truth is that we're spending $137 billion a year right now on the cost of autism, and that's based on these new numbers. So that's a staggering figure of costs. That same money could be spent more wisely. I was talking with Rebecca Landa. She's the head of one of the autism groups at the Kennedy Krieger Center in Baltimore, and she says, you know, if we're training teachers to teach kids, when kids learn, their brains actually change. And if teachers are changing kids' brains, then we should think of it not as teaching but as neuroteaching, and give these teachers the skills they need to make the kinds of changes in kids' brains that they need to have. As they learn to do this for kids with autism and developmental disabilities, the same kind of thing will work on normal kids. So she's really suggesting that we really take a look at early education, at teaching parents to be better parents, teachers to be better teachers, and even better preschool administrators to be better preschoolers.
Daniel Dehnoon, senior medical writer for WebMD. Thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate
Michael,
it.
It's always a pleasure.
Just when you thought we were in the front of the game when it came to fighting terrorism and everything, we're not doing so well when it comes to hackers wanting to attack our country from overseas. Devlin Barrett is joining us, Wall Street Journal reporter in Washington, D.C. It's amazing, as your piece starts off, the FBI's top cyber cop is the guy who says, we're not winning.
Yeah, it's a pretty grim assessment, and it's based on, frankly, a lot of cases that he can't talk about. It's a little hard to know exactly what he bases those conclusions on, other than sort of a bunch of cases that harmed national security. And basically what he's saying is, you know what, the current system, the status quo for fighting hackers is unsustainable, is how he put it.
We're talking with Devlin Barrett, Wall Street Journal reporter in Washington, D.C. Now, what we're talking about when it comes to hacking is not just, you know, somebody trying to go in and take your bank account information, but we're talking about our infrastructure, electrical power plants, nuclear reactors, et cetera. Is the problem that we're not hiring the bad guys? Because I thought the FBI was doing that for a while, because they seem to be the ones who really know everything.
I think there's a couple of different ways to look at it, and you know, this is a thing where even the experts will disagree on what the best weapon is in terms of fighting off these people. I think generally speaking, though, what Sean Henry's point, the FBI official's point, was that if you have someone who has just superior hacking skills, it is very hard to create any kind of large-scale system that can keep that type of person out forever. So his argument is you need to be patrolling inside your own network with the assumption that you've already been breached, and that has to be just sort of a constant activity for you. And that's a different way of thinking about it than the way many companies think about this issue right now.
So what is the hope? Is there any hope that he offers? Because he's apparently going into retirement at this point.
Well, he's going to take a private sector cybersecurity job. So he's staying in the field. He's just retiring from government after about 20-plus years in the Bureau.
So should we just, like, you know, crawl under a desk and start rocking back and forth? I mean, what hope do we have?
I don't think that's his point. I think his point is that so much of life, of modern life, has migrated onto computers that we need to reevaluate how we protect that life and protect ourselves from everyone, from you and me as consumers, to CEOs as people who run multi-billion-dollar corporations. And you need to both the stuff that's really secure. He made a reference to, you know, if your company has a secret sauce, that's the reason your company exists. You should not put the secret sauce on your network. And, you know, I think, frankly, the impulse in the way people build computer systems is to just put everything on every network and to have it all available because it's easier that way. And I think part of his point is some things should still be hard to do, and we should not do things that make things easy for us if, at the same time, they make very bad things easy for hackers.
Devlin Barrett, Wall Street Journal reporter in Washington. Thanks so much for being with us. I think I'm still worried, but I appreciate it.
It's going to be okay. Don't get too worried. I mean, at the end of the day, maybe one of us wins the Mega Millions. I don't know.
You never know. Devlin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks much, Michael.
I did, however, get my tickets, just you know, for the record. It's time now for your news wrap. Here's the Wall Street Journal's Bruce Vail.
The House of Representatives approved a $3.5 trillion budget proposal that would reduce spending by $5 trillion more than President Obama's budget recommendations. The proposal would overhaul the federal Medicare program and would reduce taxes and spending on certain programs. It was championed by House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, but it's destined to be defeated in the Senate. Its passage in the House, though, will be used by Republicans to contrast the spending priorities of each party. It has been a week of strange airport and airplane incidents. Today, a 28-year-old Pennsylvania man was arrested after he tried to take a bottle full of explosive flash powder and some M80 fireworks through airport security at Philadelphia International Airport. Joseph Picklow faces a federal charge of trying to carry an explosive device aboard a plane, though Picklow says he doesn't know how the flash powder and fireworks got in his bag. A Pennsylvania judge today ruled that the child molestation trial of former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky will be delayed by 3 weeks until June 5th. Sandusky's attorney had requested more time to prepare. Sandusky is accused of sexually assaulting 10 boys over a 15-year period. The first outside audit of Apple's supply chain found excessive working hours and health and safety issues at its largest manufacturer, Foxconn. The audit puts more pressure on Apple to end workers' rights violations in China. The investigation of Foxconn was conducted by the Fair Labor Association. That's a group that Apple just joined back in January. Some people want the U.S. Treasury Department to do this, but today the Canadian government said it was withdrawing the penny from circulation because it costs more than a penny to make. The Royal Canadian Mint will cease distribution of the penny late this year, although the coins will still retain their value and people can still use the ones they have.
Eh?
By the way, have you ever had that Royal Canadian Mint? It's really good on ice cream.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's really, you've really got candy on the mind. I don't know what it is. All right. Thank you, Bruce. Ooh, the Allman Brothers. That's nice, too. Oh, I'm sorry. I digress. As the Daily Wrap continues, should employers be asking for your Facebook or your Twitter or your Instagram logons before they give you a job? That and more. Straight ahead here on the Daily Wrap from the Wall Street Journal.
The Daily Wrap with Michael Kastner. More illuminating, less agitating. It's Get Connected, the Daily Wrap's look at the latest news and updates in the world of social media.
The Daily Wrap continues. Michael Kastner with you. The U.S. House of Representatives has rejected an effort to give the FCC the power to stop employers from asking job applicants for their password for Facebook or Twitter or any other social networking site. Joining us right now is Daniel Priebus. He's a partner at Bryan Cave in Washington, D.C. You know, for the life of me, I don't see why an employer needs to get into your Facebook page and why it's okay.
Well, Michael, I'm not a proponent of that practice. I'm an attorney, and my job is to advise on whether that practice is lawful or desirable.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, there are some situations where employers may have a valid need. For example, if someone is applying for a very sensitive government job, say for the Secret Service or the Central Intelligence Agency or the FBI,
mm-hmm.
Government already does a lot to ask personal questions, go talk to neighbors and so forth. And for highly sensitive positions, there certainly may be some invasion of privacy that just goes with the territory. So I think when we address this issue, we have to look at all the different situations it may arise in, and not just the sort of the standard situation where it certainly seems to be an unreasonable practice.
Well, we are in a new day and age, but I do not see the difference. And this is where I'm looking at your expertise here. What is the difference of me sending out a text to a whole group of my friends on my cell phone and a private Facebook page? Do you have the right to say, hand over your cell phone? I'm going through all of your records in your cell phone. I'm going to go through all of your texts. I'm going to go deep into your private conversations that you're having, because they are private. If your Facebook page is locked, it is private. I mean, where do we draw the line at this point?
Well, I think the line right now is that an employer is not allowed to have unauthorized access to your cell phone records or your Facebook site or what have you. The issue is whether when you're dealing with a job applicant, you can ask for that applicant's consent mm-hmm. to access their private area. Consensual authorization is different than unauthorized
access.
Well,
no, I'm with you on that, but here's my problem. I think it's bullying. I do. I think that what this is we have the ability to dig into your private information. We're in an economy where you need the job. And to me, it's going overboard, unless, as you point out, there's a sensitive job or there's a real need to do it. And for the life of me, I don't understand why they're allowed to do it unless there is an absolute need, as you say, CIA or a government job, or you're going to be around kids. We want to be able to check you out 100%. I have yet to hear anybody give a good reason for companies to do this other than, hey, you want a job in this tough economy? You better do what we tell you.
Well, Michael, as I said before, I'm not a proponent of this practice being used generally.
Mm-hmm.
The issue, though, from a legal standpoint, is not whether it's something that is an invasion of privacy. It surely is an invasion of privacy. The question is whether it's illegal under current law. So where I think we are right now is this practice has gotten a lot of attention, which is one reason we're talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the short period ahead of us, I expect there will be some legislation on the state level and possibly on the federal level.
Well, I'm glad I have your phone number, because I have a weird feeling, Daniel, that when we get done with this interview, my bosses are going to come in and say, yeah, we're going to need your password to your Facebook. Daniel Priebus, partner at Bryan Cave Law Firm in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I have waited to play a clip like this for years. Now we take you to the news desk and Ron Burgundy.
Let me give you some words of advice.
Okay.
Fire your hair lady.
Okay.
Okay, fire your makeup lady. Fire your gay wardrobe man.
Yeah.
and just go under the knife, okay?
Okay.
Go into your doctor's office and point at your face and say, Doc, it's a page one rewrite.
Oh, my God.
It was Ron Burgundy appearing on Conan O'Brien's show, which was amazing because I'd forgotten Conan was still on. I mean, the poor man has been fired so many times. Here's the big announcement on Conan last night. Again, we take you to Ron Burgundy live.
I want to announce this to everyone here in the Americas, to our friends in Spain, Turkey, and the UK, including England. That as of 0900 Mountain Time, Paramount Pictures and myself, Ronald Joseph Aaron Burgundy, have come to terms on a sequel to Anchorman.
Oh, yeah, Anchorman 2. Is that cool? I love that movie. Oh, it's just absolutely. What was that cologne called? Was it Sex Panther? That's exactly what I thought. And apparently it was just absolutely disgusting. Can I give a shout out real quick to AMC Theaters? God bless you. God bless you, folks. What they are doing is anybody under the age of 17 can attend a screening of the film Bully. And we've talked about this film Bully. It has very graphic language in it because that's what bullying is about. Harvey Weinstein's company has put this out. If you have a guardian or a signed permission slip, and you can go to get the permission slip. It's going to be available at some point on AMC's website. Apparently it's available now. It was given an R rating, and they weren't able to show it in so many places. And AMC Theaters is allowing. Kids should see this film. They absolutely should see it. So AMC, hats off to you. From the Wall Street Journal, I'm Michael Kastner, and that is your Daily Wrap.